The Manti Te'o hoax started with an epic myth. Manti Te'o, a star Notre Dame linebacker and a finalist for the Heisman Trophy, was inspired to play by the love for his girlfriend, who died mid-season of cancer. As Notre Dame marched toward the national championship game, the story got wide play in the mainstream media. But then a sensational scoop by the irreverent website Deadspin brought the truth to light. Manti Te'o's girlfriend did not even exist. I'm Marshall Allen, a reporter here at ProPublica. The Muckreads podcast features investigative reporters sharing the behind-the-scenes details about an important investigative story. In this podcast, I interview Deadspin reporters Timothy Burke and Jack Dickey, who got the scoop on the Manti Te'o hoax. I began by asking them to tell us about their website, Deadspin. So the Deadspin tagline is sports news without favor, access, or discretion. So I'm wondering if you can start off by telling us a little bit about your mission of your site and how it differs from maybe more traditional media outlets.
Sure. I think the tagline's a little bit of a joke to us now because we occasionally have access. Like if we want to do a story with access, we don't have a ton of trouble getting it. We have a ton of favor for, you know, a number of our... If we have particular team allegiances, we'll write about them in such a fashion. And discretion, we have some, not much, but just a little bit. But this story, I think we have that tagline basically to say a big part of our job is to hold the mainstream sports media accountable. A lot of the time that winds up just being like calling out ESPN when they're sort of perpetuating some silly narrative about something or over-covering something that most sports fans don't care about, like Tim Tebow. But occasionally we can challenge them on sort of a more substantial basis like we did with this.
Yeah, and to say the least, you're not afraid of being irreverent and reveling in it almost, right? I mean, you're having a lot of fun with it. So can you put this story into context? For those, some of our listeners may not be real familiar with college football, but Manti Te'o was like a mythic figure almost in the college football world. Can you describe a little bit about the mythology around this guy and his girlfriend in particular?
Well, there's a mythology about the Notre Dame football program already, and we have all of these legends about Newt Rockne inventing the forward pass or win one for the Gipper and all of these stories. And Manti Te'o playing in the memory of and inspired by the deaths of his girlfriend and grandmother on the same day instantly became both a major sports story and to some degree a story outside of the world of sports. And when he had two consecutive very good games against Michigan State and then Michigan, first on the Saturday after he learned of their deaths and then supposedly the Saturday that his girlfriend was buried, he rose from being a star NFL linebacking prospect to being a legitimate Heisman Trophy candidate.
So you guys get the tip that this story is not what it seems and that this myth is truly a myth. How did you get the tip? When did it come? What form did it come in? Tell us about the tip.
Yeah, so we got a tip over email the Friday before we published. And at Deadspin, we sort of rely on our tips line a lot. Like, I mean, we know to cover something if it's coming into tips, if three or four people have tipped us off about it. So we'll get up, I don't know, 100 emails a day maybe? Does that sound right?
Probably about 100.
Yeah. So, I mean, most of them are not of the variety of like crazy tips we should investigate. Most of them are just like, I saw this article or I saw this story. I mean,
you know, PR pitches.
We get some PR pitches and some people who are mad about our coverage of something or other. But occasionally we will get sort of out there things to investigate.
So what did the email say?
The email said, I'm from Hawaii and people around here know that Manti Te'o is a fraud, that his story about his dead girlfriend is made up. It's not true. He's never met her, and he hasn't met her because she doesn't exist. Now, the tipster also said stuff that turned out not to be true in the course of our reporting. He said that Manti had basically killed this girl off once she had become too big to manage, which we don't believe to be true. I think that's fair, right?
Right, right.
The thrust of his email was this is what I know. I've done a little bit of amateur detective work on it, but I trust you guys could do a better job and could unmask Manti.
Now, apparently this tip, I don't know if it's the exact same one, but ESPN had gotten a similar tip as well, right? Did you know this at the time?
Well, Tim, you want to take this? Talk about the ESPN tip?
Well, we believe the ESPN tip not to have come from a tipster, but to have come from Manti Te'o's agent himself. In fact, that's been reported in the New York Times and SI elsewhere.
Okay, was this after you started making calls?
No, because so after we published the story, ESPN's PR guy said, just to clarify, we've been working on this story for about 10 days. And our initial reaction was, oh, ESPN's trying to poo-poo our big scoop. I don't think that was what they were doing. I think they were trying to clarify to angry viewers or readers or whatever, just sort of that they had been aware that something was going on and just hadn't been able to confirm it. Later, we found out that the tip came from Te'o's agents who, according to Sports Illustrated, contacted ESPN because they thought it was something they might want to get in front of. That was the basis of their tip. So it was, we may in the near future need to stage an interview because something weird has happened with Manti Te'o's girlfriend. We'll get back to you.
I see.
About that interview.
And how reliable did you think this tip was? I mean, did you feel like, oh, we got to check into this right away? Or did you go, oh, another kook?
Well, I was actually out taking one of my very rare days off when we got the tip. I was in an orange grove at the time. So I returned home and had a series of instant messages from Jack and from our editor-in-chief, Tommy Craggs, saying, hey, this is something worth looking into. And so, you know, Jack had been looking into it for a while, and then, you know, I went to Google. I Googled the name, Lene Kakua. And what I saw immediately told me that this is something that we needed to look into.
And so did you have an element of excitement at this point? Because the other thing is, to put it into context, this would be a huge, huge scoop. So, you know, when you get something like that as a reporter, you start getting the adrenaline starts pumping. Am I right?
Yeah, that was, I mean, that when I read it in email, I'm sort of like a conspiracy-minded guy, and we have a group chat system, Campfire. I put it into Campfire like 2 minutes after the email came in, like, I'm going to look into this because this is awesome. And then, you know, I started talking to Burke and Tommy. And I mean, to answer your question from earlier, like, we weren't sure how reputable the tip was, but we knew that if it was right, we would be able to verify it pretty easily. We could at least get a sense of the records that didn't exist for her. And then so Burke and I and Tommy, by like the end of the day, Friday, we're all sort of excited. And Tommy was G-chatting like, I want this so bad. Like, this is the best Deadspin story. We got to do this.
And so did you get, though, at all a sense of how much is at stake here? Because one thing that weighs on me, and I know my other colleagues here at ProPublica, when you do investigative reporting, you're going out on a limb to find out something that other people don't know and often don't want you to know. And there could be legal ramifications if you're wrong. Here's a guy who's a number one draft pick. He's going to be wealthy as anything. If you get this story wrong, he will not unlikely sue you. And not only that, it could cause his draft status to be reduced. It could cost him money. Sometimes it can be kind of paralyzing, these thoughts of, oh wow, what if we make a mistake? Did any of that go through your head?
It did, but after about 24 hours of looking into the story, we had located the person who actually appeared in the pictures. And at that point, we felt, at the very least, we had a story that whatever was presenting itself as Manti Te'o's girlfriend is actually a living person who has never met Manti Te'o. We knew that fairly early on.
You had a minimum story.
Right.
And that she had also given us the name of the person who she believed to be the person behind it, and that name corresponded with another tip that we had gotten. You know, now we had two different sources pointing toward who was the real person.
Yeah, that's Renaya Tuiasosopra, right, was the one who's allegedly behind this. So tell us first, how did you track down the girl whose photo was being used as the girlfriend?
Well, the first thing we had to do was try to collect every image that had been used by the alleged Lene Kakua to represent herself online. That was difficult because all of her accounts, her Instagrams and most of the Twitter accounts, et cetera, had been shut down. So we had to use various services that collect what user pics looked like at the time, and we sort of, you know, build a collection of maybe 15 or
very,
so pictures.
Various services. Like, what do you mean? Do sites do this? Or?
Sites that collect old tweets or, you know, searchable databases of Twitter pictures often will cache the user's image at that time or a link to that image. And fortunately, maybe I shouldn't say this because maybe they'll change the policy on this. Twitter never deletes any user pictures. So every Twitter picture that has been used to represent as an avatar for that user, those are all kept in its original format on the server in perpetuity. So as long as you have the URL to that image, you can find it. And by using these pictures and then doing a series of reverse image searches using various services, including Google's own reverse image search, we were able to find a account for someone who was not listed as Lene Kakua that had that same image as one that she had posted to Twitter as its profile image. And by using the information on that individual's, it was actually her MySpace page. By using the individual's MySpace page to gather other information, we were able to find her name. By having her name, we found her on Facebook, and then we contacted her.
And what did she say when you got in touch with her? How did you reach her?
Well, I sent her a Facebook message, and she sent me one right back saying, "What's your number? I'm concerned about this." So she called me the next morning. And
what day are we on here?
Monday.
Monday. We're already okay.
I had found her on Saturday, and I had sent her the Facebook message, and she did not get back to me on Sunday.
Sunday, we spent mostly watching football too.
Right.
As a staff.
Sunday, I also contacted.
Even the scoop went on hold.
Well,
wow.
I did contact, and this may have prompted her to actually get in touch with me, that there was one public image on her Facebook profile, and it had a person tagged in that image. I also sent a message to that person saying, "We're trying desperately to get in touch with this individual." Which, right. She's gone on TV. We can say her name. It's Diane. Her name
right.
is Diane.
Mm-hmm.
So Diane calls me on Monday morning and says, "Okay, you know, what's the deal?" And I had prepared a list of images that had been used by Lene Kakua to represent herself online. And I sent that list of images to Diane. And I said, "Can you identify which of these pictures you appear in?"
Right, because we were still unsure whether there was one woman in all the Lene photos or whether they were a number of women.
Right.
And Diane said back to me, "It's me in all of them." She had appeared in all of the pictures. And furthermore, one of the pictures she knew was not public. It was not something she had put on her Facebook or her Instagram, but it was a picture that she had taken specifically for one person and sent it to that one person as a favor. And that one person was Ronaya Tuiasosopo.
So she learned that her image, her picture, was being used publicly on Twitter and elsewhere as Manti Te'o's girlfriend who had died. How did she feel about this?
Well, she wasn't entirely sure who Manti Te'o was. She sort of confused him with Johnny Manziel, who actually won the Heisman. And so she sort of looked him up, and I said, "Well, no, it's the guy who lost the Heisman." And she was in shock.
Disappointed it wasn't Johnny Football
right.
himself.
Yeah. She was in shock and wasn't entirely sure how to process it. But she did know immediately that she needed to call Ronaya Tuiasosopo. And then she called me immediately after her phone conversation with him and reported to me exactly how he reacted. And his reaction told us a lot about his involvement and how the hoax went about the
entire
time.
What did she say about how he responded?
She said that he, quote, freaked out, unquote. He started acting really weird, but that he assured her that he would take care of it and there was nothing to worry about. And in Diane's words, she said, "He said there's nothing for me to worry about when my picture is all over the internet as a dead woman. I'm worried."
Now, what are your priorities at this point when you're thinking about this story? Are you thinking more about being first? Because being first is a big deal with a story like this. Or are you thinking about we need to make sure this is right or both?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's both. I mean, with first, I think what we didn't really hear footsteps in the process, but at the same time, we knew that there were two problems if we reached out too early in the process to try to get the story from at least Te'o or from Notre Dame.
Right.
The first problem is that because it's a social media story, people can erase things, and some of which Tim and I can find, some of which they can't. We can't if it's been deleted. So that was our first concern, that basically if you spook people who are involved in the story, they're going to go dark. And a lot of people actually who talk to, I mean, peripheral characters who we didn't get to talk to in the reporting process have deleted their accounts since the story published. That was the first concern. And then the second concern is basically if you tell Manti Te'o and Notre Dame that you're sitting on this story, we learned afterward they had been already in conversation with ESPN. And so they go to ESPN, they're going to tell an incomplete version of the story. They're going to tell, I mean, basically the story that Manti has been telling in public since, which we don't know whether it's true or not. We know that he lied to the press about his girlfriend having died from December 6th through the 8th. So our concern was just that, was not so much that we hurry with the story, but that we do it quickly enough that we not get scooped by one of the principals in the story.
Yeah, not let them spin it in their own way and undermine the truth, which is what you're trying to report and get that out there. So what other steps did you take to essentially, the difficulty here is proving a negative, right? Trying to prove that someone did not exist.
Well, we had a lot of help from other members of our staff, including Dom Cosentino and Tom Lee, who did a lot of the work to prove things that we already knew were true. Calling Stanford and getting them to, you know, finally, and that was sort of a struggle to get Stanford to confirm for us that nobody by the name, you know, Kekua had ever attended school there or especially had graduated, which was reported in several, you know, prominent publications that she was an alumna. We also, you know, had to call the LA County Health Department and make sure that nobody had died under that name. Things that we already knew because we had already sort of solved the hoax part of it in the first few days, but we had to go back and do some of these, I mean, legwork to further bolster into what we already knew, but be able to establish that for our readers.
Right. Dom was calling funeral homes in Carson to ask if they had processed anyone by that name. And, you know, that's a big step to take. I mean, especially Tommy Craggs, he was, you know, dead set about just retracing every step we possibly could in the reporting process so we would get at least the central fact that this girl didn't exist. Right.
Right. So it's ultimately this process of verification is kind of what we all do, right, on these kind of stories. How many people were involved in this process total in the whole story?
And so there were the two, Tim and I, then our two editors, Tommy Craggs, who's the editor-in-chief, and Tom Skoka, who's the managing editor. Then we had reporting help from Dom Cosentino and Tom Lay, and then Jim Cook did the art, so all told, I guess, seven of us.
And what about when you did go to the family in Notre Dame? When did you decide to do that? When did you pull the trigger on that, and how did that go down?
That was Wednesday, a little bit more than an hour before we published the story. If we had gotten in touch with them or gotten something from them, we might have changed the time of publication. We weren't saying we will contact them an hour before we publish a story.
Right, but you had a draft down, you had a story ready, and you could have changed it if you would have heard something.
Right. And so we tried calling Manti. The phone number we had for him wasn't taking calls. We tried calling Brian Te'o. He was in a meeting and declined to speak to us.
You did tell him who you were. Did you tell him what you were writing about? Did you tell him what the story was?
Actually, I don't know. I think we told him, we said it was about Lene, I believe, but it was Tommy making those calls.
Yeah, Craig's made that call. I did call the assistant AD for football or the press officer for football at Notre Dame. And, you know, I talked to a secretary there and sort of insisted it was an urgent call that we needed to comment. And she decided that my call wasn't urgent enough and instead patched me to a voicemail. And in that voicemail, I said, here's the story that we are about to publish. We need a comment from you as soon as possible. And in the hour or so that followed, we did not get an answer.
Now, another process we go through here is we lawyer everything. Did you have a lawyer look at this?
I think so.
One thing that's sort of important to understand about the reporting of this is that Jack was home in Connecticut. And I live in St. Petersburg,
right,
Florida. So neither of us were working from the Gawker Media offices during all of this. We were only communicating with our editors through the computer or on the phone. And so anything that was happening in the office, which any conversations with legal would have happened, we were not really privy to those conversations.
Yeah. Although I can say, I mean, I assume Tommy talked to the lawyers because that's anytime we do that if we do a big story, we do that. and nothing got walked back from our initial draft. None of the factual claims. So I mean,
so it's a standard thing there. You have a legal review on big stories.
Yeah,
so you,
and it's
but
not,
it's not always at your level necessarily.
Right.
And the other thing is Gawker publishes stories with much more potential legal ramifications.
Yeah,
than,
right.
There's a
type of a risk level you can go with any story where you can be extremely conservative or you can be a lot more risky. And in this, in my opinion, I mean, when I read the first story, I was like, whoa, man, anonymous sources. Okay, now I know you guys know who it is, but I'm reading the story. I'm going anonymous sources, Nexus searches, which, you know, those can sometimes be, you know, again, you're trying to prove a negative, right? And Nexus isn't always totally complete. But the thing that you did have was the girl. I think the girl was like the linchpin almost, right? But there were essentially like two things that you asserted in the story, two primary things, or at least the way I read it. One was the girlfriend's a hoax. No question, that one turned out to be absolutely accurate. But what about the second thing, which at least it implied that he was in on it, right? In his story now, he comes out and he says, I didn't know, you know, I was tricked. I didn't know until the story came out it wasn't true. I mean, what do you think now about your original story? Like, are you still 100% sure that was it, or was it a variation possibly?
Well, we simply sent out to report what we knew and what we had been told by people that we believed and had evidence of intimate knowledge of the hoax. And nearly everyone that we spoke with, all the way back to the original tipster, you know, either said explicitly or implied that Manti Te'o had some involvement in it. And that's, you know, we quoted one of them in the piece, but we had two other people who were very close to the situation, including one of Tuiasosopo's relatives who came in as a tipster late in the story to try and force him to tell the truth, who, when asked, said, you know, I believe that Te'o is involved in this. So when the majority of your insiders to a situation all say that they believe something, I think that we had an obligation to communicate that, even if we did it in somewhat of a composite manner.
Right.
I think that, and I've tried to, you know, communicate this elsewhere. If they had all said, I don't think that he had anything to do with it, we think he's completely a victim, we would have had the obligation to report that as well.
So you had a lot. How many off-the-record sources do you think weighed into that decision-making then?
Four or five.
Yeah. But there were also pretty people who are really close to Manti Te'o or Ronnie Tuiasosopo.
There was no one who was close to Te'o we got to talk, but we did talk to people who were close to Renaya.
So anytime I do a story like this, I know from my colleagues here, when the story publishes, you know, there's that moment of, I mean, it's just almost panic, you know, almost like, I know that I've nailed this down. I am 100% confident in this story, but you're still almost wondering, what if there's something out there I don't know about? Did you guys have any of those moments going through your head?
Tommy definitely did. Burke and I were feeling pretty good about this just because we had pinned down the girl. We had seen a number of people who had accused Renaya of being in on it before his name even came up in our reporting. So we were feeling all right. But I was told that at the offices, they all, when Notre Dame released a statement saying that she was a hoax, they were all jumping for joy and high-fiving and stuff just because they were going through that doubt more than we were.
Right, right. And the story was immediately updated, I should say, too, because some of this, it is a little bit incremental, right? As you learn things, you update the story.
Yeah. Right. You know, I think that we set out to, I think, establish two answers. You know, one, is she real? And two, is, you know, Renaya Tuiasosopo behind it? And within, you know, a short period of time, we had, you know, the University of Notre Dame and Manti Te'o, and then, you know, later in his off-camera interview with Jeremy Schapp, saying that it was Renaya Tuiasosopo. And so, you know, we have the principal victim in this saying that the key findings of our article are correct. I didn't really get excited about that because I feel like we already knew that. I feel that we were that confident in our reporting that there was nothing to sort of celebrate.
So do you still think that he was in on it, or do you think that he truly was duped in this hoax?
In on it's kind of thorny. I mean, our sort of current belief, and I think we're writing everything we write really is to this effect, is that Te'o exaggerated his relationship with Lene, particularly after she died. And there are a number of pieces of evidence that would point to this being the case. You know, she never turned up in coverage of Notre Dame until after she died. He said she was in a coma in L.A. and he couldn't miss his flight to go see her, even though he knew she was in a coma. She was 15 minutes away from him in Hawaii. He couldn't commandeer a car to go see her. Just stuff like that that he's told Jeremy Schapp and told Katie Couric just sort of indicates this woman was not the love of his life, that she was just a girl he was talking to on the internet, on the phone occasionally. And so that's, I mean, Burke and I have sort of been describing it as a third hoax on top of a number of, I mean, there are just so many hoaxes going on here. The first hoax was that this girl existed. The second hoax is that, what is the second hoax?
That she had to fake her death in order to get away from drug dealers.
Well, so yeah, there was that hoax. I mean, there's so many layers here that like, it's sort of impossible to know. I mean, what the biggest untruth?
Which one is the third hoax?
Well,
the third hoax is that Lene Kekua was the love of Manti Te'o's life.
Right, which makes the story much better if it's true, obviously, right?
Right. I mean, that was something that only emerged after she had died. And
without that, there would be no myth.
Right. And she had been in a car accident, a near-fatal car accident in April when they were supposedly together, although Manti said the relationship got stronger after her car accident. She was in a coma. She had leukemia. And none of this ever was mentioned until after she died, and then it became the myth.
Even after all of the summer, media appearances, media days for Notre Dame, all the interviews with Manti Te'o, you would expect I'm dedicating this season to my girlfriend who has leukemia. You would expect that to come up. But no, it only came up after she died. And it's very convenient because if you think that someone is dead, then they can't refute anything that you say about them. This is one of those bizarre instances where the person who was dead could refute them because the person wasn't dead.
Right, exactly. So we're getting very esoteric and philosophical now about life and death, people who don't exist. But the story hits and the internet essentially explodes. I was telling someone else this. I can't think of another story that has just resounded through the culture on all levels so fast and in so many places. What was that? Did you guys expect this type of response to the story?
No. I mean, we expected it would be a compelling story about college football and a compelling story about the sports media. And those corners reacted strongly to it, but so many other people who wouldn't have read Deadspin in the first place and wouldn't have really been aware of the Manti Te'o story were also responding to it, which surprised me.
How do you guys describe how it resonated? Why do you think it did?
Well, there are two really huge parts of the story. There's the Manti Te'o having a fake dead girlfriend and the person behind it. But there's also the, hey, look, the sports media and the media in general have been reporting a story that wasn't true. And we sort of highlighted both of those. And what I really sort of I expected the media to downplay this story that we had published out of embarrassment, that, you know, why would they highlight this article that says, oh, hey, major institution published a story that has things that aren't facts. Our article, while not specifically in a pay on to this or whatever, but it's about fact checking. And we sort of thought that the institutions who didn't do the fact checking that led to this being able to be a story in the first place would sort of downplay it. And to their credit, they, you know, have embraced it.
I mean, ESPN was saying the word Deadspin on air over and over again for a few days, which obviously killed them and gratified us.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming in today. Thanks for giving us the behind-the-scenes story. It's very interesting.
Yeah, thanks.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us on.
That was Timothy Burke and Jack Dickey. You can read their investigation, Manti Te'o's Dead Girlfriend, the most heartbreaking and inspirational story of the college football season is a hoax, at deadspin.com. For ProPublica, I'm Marshall Allen. Thanks for listening.